and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. A pattern has emerged. The more the West panics over its failed Ukraine project, the more it is willing to escalate the conflict, the same conflict that they say they're not directly involved in. The last thing they are considering is a negotiated settlement. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest Larry Johnson in Tampa. He's a managing partner for Berg Associates, a former CIA analyst and U.S. State Department counterterrorism official. In Lake Jackson, we have Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And here in Moscow, we have Stanislav Krapivnik. He is a former U.S. Army officer and veteran. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you. So many things have been happening over the last few days. The usual nonsense coming from the French president, contradictory information coming from Sergeant Schultz in Germany, and then, of course, we have these German generals talking. But, you know, all in all in, if you want to kind of distill down what's going on, it's what's called sunk cost fallacy. They cannot comprehend that they have put so many resources into a project that has failed utterly, but they're willing to double down. Daniel.
Well, you know, here we have Senator Marco Rubio from Florida, who I think it was yesterday, said, I knew all along Ukraine couldn't win. I just didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to, you know, discourage anyone or dissuade anyone. And I think that's the cat out of the bag. I remember after a few years in Iraq, you started seeing people, all the think tankers and all the experts started saying that, well, I knew all along it was a bad idea. Well, I knew all along they didn't have WMDs. I just didn't say anything. So I think when you start seeing the rats like Rubio fleeing the sinking ship, I think, you know, at least in the U.S., the game is up. And when you talk about, we'll talk about later, the money and the Republican Party in the U.S. as we move into the electoral season, it doesn't look good from the U.S. side for Ukraine.
Well, you know, Larry, there seems to be this infallibility complex that these people have. They just cannot comprehend that they have, on a major scale. Look, Afghanistan, Iraq, that's far away. You can say it was a long time ago. But this is impacting the world in a way that they never could have imagined, particularly Europe here. And it's reputational damage here. They are not infallible, and that's what they're finding out. Larry.
Well, there's a widening gulf between the rhetoric and the capability. So on the one hand, as we saw with the intercepted conversations with the Germans, you know, there's always talk about, boy, yeah, we want to escalate this, or we want to look at using the Taurus missile to hit the Kerch Bridge. But then at the same time, they concede, well, yeah, okay, it's going to take 8 months. We can't do it right away. Remember the 1 million shells we were going to produce for Ukraine? Oh, well, okay, we did 300,000. So across the board, The U.S. military can't meet its recruiting goals. The British have what I call ejectile dysfunction. They can't launch a missile out of a submarine. And so from the actual military capability that NATO has, it's a wreck. It's a disaster. And yet, what they're saying and the threats that they're making towards Russia are becoming sort of more intense. So there really is a disconnect there.
Well, Larry, before I go to Stanislav here, can you just give us an assessment of the French army right now?
Well, by the way, the
I was going to ask Larry what the French army, what is its status right now? I mean, is it a major power?
No.
Okay, hold that thought. I'm going to go to Stanislav right now. Well, the French president is talking about sending troops. Now, I don't speak French. I've looked at the transcript. It's hard to say if he's saying French troops or NATO troops. It's unclear, at least my reading of it. But what about that? I mean, we're talking about escalation. This is what this program's called. Expect escalation. NATO troops in Ukraine? Really? Stanislav.
Well, first of all, by the way, the ejection issue isn't just with the British. The Germans showed the same thing in the Red Sea when they tried to down an American drone that they took to be a hostile. Two missiles, both missed, fell into the sea. So it's a NATO-wide issue. You know, even in the 90s and beginning 2000s, when I was serving, you could watch the degradation in discipline. You could watch the degradation in combat readiness that was already underway. Macron, now the French do have units that can go. They've got the French Foreign Legion, they've got Special Forces troops, but they're not enough to fight an actual war. So I think what they're hoping is once they go in, they'll pull the rest of NATO in with them, behind them. It's one thing if it's just the French or it's the pre-Baltic states that go in there and they'll back off. It's a different thing. If it's the Poles or the pre-Baltics, a different thing if it's the French, the Germans, or the British go in. They've got enough weight to pull most of NATO behind them, whether NATO likes it or not. Once the bullets start flying, logic starts changing radically.
Well, I don't want to be too blunt here, but I mean, won't a Russian missile kill a NATO soldier just like it kills a Ukrainian one? What's the difference?
Right.
Well, we can ask the 60 or so French soldiers in Kharkiv that got a Iskandar
on their
head.
Thank you for reminding our audience there. Maybe that is what got Macron all set off. I mean, he always has these triggers around him. We've gotten used to that with the French president. Daniel, staying with Macron, he said essentially that Russia should not be allowed to win. I think really what he's saying is that NATO should not be allowed to lose.
Well, I was really confused when he said that because I thought they already were winning. Isn't that what they've been saying for 2 years? It's over. They've already won. You know, I mean, I was listening, I guess, to the wrong U.S. generals who said that they'd already won. So it does smack of desperation. And, you know, it's they're sending all sorts of signals. The intercepted conversation, which actually the Germans are saying today, it wasn't intercepted at all. It was basically a boomer mistake. One of the generals didn't dial in right. And so, don't blame us. We're still secure. Don't worry. They haven't heard anything we said. But these things keep leaking out, and they keep pointing in one direction, which, as you appropriately titled the show, escalation. And I just wonder, it seems like the little Baltics are just chomping at the bit to get in, if this is some sort of signal for them to get more involved.
Well, Daniel, what do they actually have? I mean, NATO consists of two major militaries, the United States, which is far away. It has bases in Europe, obviously. And there's Turkey. Turkey's not going to get involved in this whatsoever. So what is left? I mean, what should Russia be worried about?
Well, it's desperation because we're moving. Now, with every day, it becomes clearer and clearer. And this is particularly true yesterday when the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, states, you can't kick a guy off the ballot because you don't like him. It's becoming clearer and clearer that Trump will be the nominee, and the numbers are certainly his way when you look at national polls. So Trump, for all of his faults, and there are plenty of them, he, at least to this point, has not displayed an appetite for going all in. If you remember back when the so-called chemical attack in Syria happened, he lobbed a couple of bombs out into some field somewhere. He didn't go all in. So I think that is responsible for a good deal of the panic.
Yeah, well, Larry, what is NATO as a military force vis-a-vis Russia?
Well, they're nothing, to put it simply. Look, the reason NATO has expanded over the years is because that was the only way that NATO could maintain force level, force structure, because they weren't able to build up and sustain their own armies. I mean, right now, the British Army, I think its full strength is 70,000. And of that, if you wanted to call anybody combat capable, you're looking maybe at 30,000. Well, the Russians are chewing through that in 2 weeks. The French Army has similar challenges, as do the Germans. So across the board, you wind up with this patchwork quilt of different military capabilities, different military traditions, different military organizations. They try to standardize it. And the line that's been coming out of Washington is, oh, boy, NATO's more united than ever. Well, that meme has sort of gone away, particularly with Macron and Scholz in an ultimate catfight with each other, and the Brits, they're very unhappy with the Germans as well, because Scholz outed them as, that they're active and on the ground in Ukraine.
Well, I think you could make an argument, Stanislav, that the French and the British always are upset with the Germans. It's just a historical thing, okay? But, I mean, it's interesting, Stanislav, given the scope of our conversation so far, I think the blame game has already started. What do you think?
Well, this kind of reminds me of Obama's No Child Left Behind program for the American schools. Well, they just lowered the standards so low you couldn't leave anybody behind because anybody could step over. NATO integration has gone about the same way. We've lowered the standards so low that Latvia or Estonia looks like a military power. On the other hand, you know, to be honest, there are enough military units there that if they start a fight, it's going to be a fight. There are going to be losses on both sides. It's not going to be over in a week. It'll be over. It'll be over in only one direction, unless some miracle happens for NATO. But it's still going to be a fight. It's still going to be a war. So it's we shouldn't downgrade it totally as if there's not going to have anything to do
with
it.
Well, I mean, but Stanislav, knowing the military, I mean, if you're going to have air support, does NATO have air support in Ukraine or outside of Ukraine? If it's outside of Ukraine, isn't that a fair target?
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, the way they're doing it is the planes are hiding mostly in Poland. They fly out of Poland, they land in Ukraine on a Ukrainian air base, they fuel up, arm up, and then fly a mission. So right now, Russia's kind of ignoring that, and they're not hitting them in Poland. Mm. Now, the problem with F-16s is, A, they are made for asphalt tarmacs. They're not made for concrete tarmacs, the way the Soviet and Russian planes are made for. Two, for them to land on a concrete tarmac, they have to carry a lot less weight. Otherwise, they'll break their chassis. They'll break their landing gear. So for that matter, that means that's a lot more of a constrained mission because you got less fuel, less ordnance. Now, if they're flying out of Poland, and it's already been said, and I hope that's the line that's held, if they're flying out of Poland and going straight into a combat mission, those Polish air bases are part of the fight. And if they're part of the fight, they're a legal and moral target to be hit. So...
You summed it up. They're a target here. Gentlemen, we have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Daniel and Lake Jackson. The American angle in all of this is, of course, the aid that the Senate passed. The House refuses even to discuss at this point here. Will there be a go-around? Will there be eventually some kind of aid still going to Ukraine? Mm-hmm. Vis-a-vis, I was going to mention Marco Rubio, but given that kind of illogic of coming from Marco Rubio, some money will eventually get there because it's Biden's prestige on the line.
Yeah, I think with every passing day, it's less likely they'll get the full enchilada sent to them, the $61 billion. But again, we're moving heavily now into the election season. Trump has all but captured the nomination as the Republican, and he's essentially the head of the Republican Party in the United States now. And so you have a Republican House that literally hangs within a hair's breadth of a majority. They kicked out a Republican because he was a weirdo, and now they have basically, you know, one or two guys. So it's very important that the Republican House at least aligns itself with President Trump, and I think that's what they want to do despite the misgivings among some, shall we say, more rhino or backbencher-type Republicans. So with every day, there's more of a danger that it won't pass. But there needs, as you say, needs to be something that will pass. And Speaker Johnson is not ideologically opposed or opposed in principle to sending money to Ukraine.
Well, he voted for money in the past, okay? I mean, he was on board for that.
He has in the past, but now there's this basically the standoff about immigration. And so the Republicans, in a way, have used this as a whip against the Democrats and President Biden. We need a serious immigration bill, or we're not going to pass the money. So it's kind of a challenge, a gauntlet being thrown down now. And the Democrats can't afford to back off on immigration now. They've already lost, you know, states like Michigan, you know, to Biden has lost that because he decided to align completely with Israel, and that's another story. So you're really having something that's going on in the political sphere now that goes well beyond war fighting.
Yeah, you know, Larry, I'm sure you saw Lloyd Austin's testimony to Congress. I don't know what, you know, maybe he's just recovering from his surgery because this guy was so delusional, the scaremongering. It was so transparent as well. Again, desperation in the air. Larry.
Well, they're trying to do everything they can to put pressure on Congress to cough up the money, speaking of coughing. And here's the issue. There is not the kind of political base in the United States for Ukraine that exists for Israel. So, you know, the theme song for Congress ought to be that from the, you know, the movie Cabaret, money, 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 money. The money makes the world go round. So I do think Congress ultimately will allocate, they will approve funds for, quote, Ukraine. But the reality of that money is not going to Ukraine. It's going to General Dynamics. It's going to Raytheon. It's going to Lockheed Martin. It's staying in the United States. And then it's getting passed back to the members of Congress who are going to need to have some cash in their election coffers coming up for November. So, I mean, it's a scam. And at the same time, the United States is under great pressure from the American-Israeli Political Action Committee to pony up the funds to keep Israel in the fight. And so the United States does not have limitless military capability. They've got to make choices. And so their choices in that is they're gonna send whatever equipment, materiel, munitions to Israel, not to Ukraine. Ukraine's toast.
Yeah, well, it's Stanislav, it's very interesting there. It gets down to legal requirements to send money to Ukraine, but there's no barriers to send it to Israel. Congress, I think, has already been overridden twice by this administration. Stanislav, I have a kind of a military question for you. I mean, it's one of these things, going back to what Macron had to say, and I don't know, maybe he's just wanting to remain relevant. You know, he wants to outdo the Germans and the Brits. I don't know. There could be an internal dynamic there. But there's this sense, you know, if NATO send troops to Ukraine, the Russians won't dare touch them. That is ridiculous thinking, Stanislav.
Yeah, you know, when you're in a proxy war, you've got one of two choices when you're losing. Either leave or you double down. And it seems NATO, the problem with a lot of NATO leadership, too, is they're in an echo chamber. They hear the same thing back. They talk the same words. They speak the same words. They hear the same thing back and forth. And they keep hearing how Russia is just on the brink, just a little more, and it'll finally crack. It's the same yeah. thing as when you go to Vegas and you put your kids... Yeah. Your college funds on the line, the house, the wife's wedding ring, and just one win, and I'll get it all back. But you're not going to get it all back. You're just going to get even further broke. And you're looking basically gambling addicts. They've put everything on the line, short of their own countries. And they're willing to do that, too.
Well Stanislav, if I can use the metaphor, so I like the Vegas metaphor. So the Ukrainians are the chips, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The whole war is just this big roulette table. Spinning and they're losing. The house wins, and they're not the house as much as they want to think they're the house.
Daniel, yeah. Really, the desperation that you see coming out of the Europeans is that NATO is facing a strategic defeat, and that's something they simply can't comprehend, can they, Daniel?
No, they can't at all, and that's why you see bizarre things like German generals talking behind the backs of their commander in chief, who says no Tauruses. And then you have this leaked conversation. How many Tauruses will it take to nuke the bridge? But I wanted to pick up on something that Stanislav said, because he makes an excellent point. And it reminds me so much that we have learned nothing from Iraq. Because I remember when I was working in the House with Dr. Paul, endless Foreign Affairs Committee hearings with Fred Kagan waddling in there, sitting down and telling us, just one more surge, guys, just one more surge. We've almost got this thing won. For both Iraq and Afghanistan, by the way. So this is the garbage that they've pulled all along. They haven't learned from it because they profit from it. But picking up on something that Larry said as well, if you look at the opinion polls in the U.S., not only is aid to Ukraine extremely unpopular, particularly among Republicans, I think it's something like 75%, yeah. But certainly in the mid to high 60s overall oppose it, but even more aid to Israel. Surprisingly enough, at least the last poll I saw, 59% of Republicans are opposed to more military aid to Israel. So these wars are extremely unpopular. I can't help but think that Republicans and past and potentially future President Trump aren't looking at these polls.
You know, Larry, one of the interesting things in listening to our probably the woman that we probably all agreed should be demonized the most is Victoria Nuland. And she said twice when she was in Kiev and then later at a conference is that there'll be some surprises for Putin, as she likes to say. It seems to me, considering the German, the leaked German conversation, it's terrorism that they're going to conduct. That's what they, that's what the surprises are. Terrorist acts against civilians. Larry.
Well, yes, but Russia is, I think, aware and prepared for it. You know, this series of incidents this last week, where you first had the statement from Macron, you know, escalating, and at that, and at the same time, it came out with the New York Times article about CIA bases in Ukraine and the all the stuff that the CIA was doing for to support the Ukrainian war. And then you had Putin's speech, his State of the Union, State of Russia, and within it putting down some very clear markers about what the West is facing if they continue this. And then the leak, and I do believe the leak came from Russian intelligence. That was not accidental. They're putting the West on notice. Okay, you've played this game now for over 2 years of using of inserting yourselves in this war, but pretending that you're not there.
That's right.
Of killing Russians and not taking responsibility. That's over. And in fact, we had a news report just the other day, I think day before yesterday. It looks like the Russians did hit one of the CIA bases around Sumy and kill the personnel. And, you know, nobody said anything about it. They want to keep that under wraps. But I think the Russians have now made the decision. Okay, the gloves in that respect are coming off. If the NATO forces continue to insert themselves this way, we will hit them, and we will make them pay.
You know, as Stanislav, essentially the same question here. I mean, NATO has overplayed its hand. As a matter of fact, if you really think about it, NATO really never expected a long-term conflict. They believed in the fantasy that the Russian troops went up to Kiev and then they ran away, and you know they could call victory. Boris Johnson called it off, and now they're stuck with the hand that they dealt themselves. Stanislav.
Yeah, you know. Kharkov 2, the essential thing. The Ukrainians used flying columns. No strong point was ever taken. Our neighbor's son was fighting in one of those strong points. They got pulled. They got encircled. They got pulled out by Russian by relief troops, and they stepped back. But they stepped back in an orderly manner, continued the lines that were a flexible defense. So they were falling back on new lines, until they got down to a hardened line that the Ukrainians couldn't push through. The other thing that nobody talks about is Ukraine had an armored fist that it created with several brigades, and it kept them in Kharkov around civilians, knowing that the civilians aren't going to get hit. That they're parked in underground garages, areas like that, knowing that Russia isn't going to hit those buildings. They're not going to do a Gaza on Kharkov. Well, that armored fist had to come out for this fight, and they lost a good chunk of that armored fist. So that had been putting together for a while. As far as terrorism, let's start 2014. You can ask my elderly aunt in Yasinovatov, who's been 9 years under shelling. I went, last time I saw her was in November. We came flying in there at 140 kilometers an hour through a bombed up road. You can't go slower than that. You've got drones overhead that are bringing in artillery rounds on civilian cars. You've got drones that are kamikaze drones, FVPs, flying all over the place. So you got to fly in fast just to get into the town. And then, you know, they get artillery constantly. I was standing there talking with my uncle, and you can hear the artillery rounds coming in. You know, I served long enough that if I'm going to have an artillery round landing on my head, at, you know, welcome Jesus, it's kind of that moment. I'm not going to worry about it coming down on top of my head. You know, that's how all the people live there, too.
I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because it's never enough said that this war has been going on since 2014, and the people of the Donbass were terrorized for 8 of those years. And it's something that they will never forget, and the Russian people will never forget, and the Russian political elite will never forgive the deceit that the West conducted itself around the Minsk agreements. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Tampa, Lake Jackson, and in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.